This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The entire wing, which is about the same size as one blade of a wind turbine, is moving at this higher speed, and so therefore it's able to see much more of the wind than a wind turbine would, and by virtue of that is exposed to much more wind energy.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into the archives to revisit a couple of discussions with sustainability innovators whose ideas never took full flight, but can continue to inspire us nonetheless. First, we hear from Dara O'Rourke, the CEO of GoodGuide, a really great idea for improving product transparency for consumers, which sadly shut down in 2020. Then we speak with Corwin Hardam, the CEO of solar kite company Makani Power, who tragically passed away in 2012 at the age of 38, only 1 year after this Sea Change Radio interview. I want to welcome back to Sea Change Radio, Dara O'Rourke. He is the co-founder of GoodGuide, and he's also an associate professor in environmental sciences at UC Berkeley. Dara, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
We spoke to you a few years ago where you gave our listeners an overview of the products you review and what GoodGuide is all about. If you can just refresh our memories exactly what the mission of GoodGuide is.
Absolutely. So we set out to empower consumers with much better information than they've ever had before about the environmental, the social, and the health impacts of products and companies. So we have a team of scientists and then engineers, software engineers, that have built a website, goodguide.com, and an iPhone app, an Android app, and now a set of tools to share this information across the web that rates basically any mainstream product that you would find in a store in the US. We've rated about 250,000 products in a dozen product categories: personal care, household chemicals, food, paper products, lighting products, toys, some electronics. And our mission is really to help consumers make better purchase decisions, decisions that reflect their values, that help them find safe, healthy, sustainable products, but ultimately products that match their concerns and their values. And there are lots of services on the web that'll tell you the best product that's been tested or 100 people have tried it out. But what our team is trying to do is kind of the hard research of going behind the product, behind the label, behind what they say, down the supply chain to evaluate all the ingredients within the product and potential human health or environmental impacts of those ingredients. Lots and lots of awareness since we last spoke about chemicals within personal care or cosmetics or household cleaning products that more and more consumers are concerned about the potential human impacts of those, the health impacts, the environmental impacts. More and more awareness of labor rights issues down supply chains, whether it's Apple's iPhone factories or Nike, or even in food product categories, looking at treatment of workers, treatment of animals, and I think a lot of increasing awareness of climate change over the last few years. So we see more and more consumers want to know not only is the product high quality and does it work and is it from a brand I trust, but also they want to know about will it have a potential negative impact on my health or my family's health? Will it have a negative impact on the environment? And we're really seeing the increasing growth of awareness, not only among consumers, but among some of the largest retailers in the U.S. around these issues.
And last time we focused a lot on shampoos and toothpaste. Maybe you can highlight some of the newer categories that consumers would find if they went to goodguide.com.
Sure. So we basically have tried to cover a mainstream store. So what you would find if you went to a Target or a Safeway or a CVS, and try to cover the main aisles of that store that a consumer might have concerns about. So food is a big category for us. We rate food for its nutritional value as well, again, as potential concerns around specific ingredients, artificial colors, artificial flavors, sweeteners, that increasing numbers of consumers are concerned about. And so food, a huge category for us. Pet food, also a very large category. More and more consumers, unfortunately, out of a number of scandals over the last few years of melamine showing up in pet food, contaminants showing up in pet food, killing pets across the U.S., that people shopping for pet food want to know what's in that, where was it made, is it safe and healthy for my pet? Apparel is a category that we're doing a lot of work on right now, basically implementing a sustainability screen of the apparel that you might buy. And again, the top issue for most consumers on apparel is how does it look and how does it make me feel? And we know that's what you first want, is you want to find apparel that looks good and makes you feel good and is at an affordable price. But again, more and more consumers are starting to think, okay, well, but how was the apparel made? What were the labor conditions under which it was made? With the tragedy in Bangladesh last year, what are the risks to workers in the supply chain for this? How is the company that I'm supporting doing on labor rights issues, safety issues, treatment of women and their supply chain issues? And even in apparel, we're seeing more and more of our clothing has complex chemicals on the clothing for stain resistance, for wrinkle resistance, for giving the clothing different attributes, in jeans even, all sorts of things that you may recall from 20 years ago when you bought acid wash jeans. Well, we've gone way beyond acid washes to enzyme washes and laser etchings and all sorts of new technologies to make your clothing look distressed or worn in or whatever. So across these categories, really, we're seeing more concerns among mainstream consumers for thinking about attributes that go beyond just price and quality. And so what Good Guide is trying to do is to deliver that additional information so people can find great products at great prices, but that also have been evaluated for their environmental, their social, their labor, their health impacts.
And do you take into account the quality of products in terms of if you're doing an apparel product? Do you say, well, this has amazingly good social justice and sustainability ratings, but it looks like crap? do you not like take into account the traditional consumer quality ratings?
Well, so what we've found is that for issues like how does something look, or how does something taste, or how does something make my hair look, the community or the crowd, if you will, is very good at that kind of evaluation. And so we will bring in essentially community recommendations, community user reviews as a measure of does the product taste good, or did my kid like it, or did I like it when I used it? So for essentially for product efficacy and satisfaction, we look to the crowd for user reviews. And that has become a very powerful kind of voice for evaluating products and their efficacy and people's satisfaction. But for issues of toxicology or global climate change or even labor rights, human rights issues, we find that the crowd is not so good at evaluating those issues. They don't have good information. It often turns into shouting matches. You can't really get very good information on these complex issues down global supply chains. So what we're trying to do is combine the best of scientific review and evaluation. We have chemists on staff. We have toxicologists. We have environmental life cycle assessment experts that can do that work, and then bringing that together with what the community is good at. So if you will, here's a product that people like you liked. They thought it worked well, it tasted good, it made them look good, and it's been scientifically assessed to be healthy and safe and sustainable. That for us is a great combination.
This is our last goodbye. I hate to feel the love between us die, but it's over. Just hear this and I'll go.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Dara O'Rourke. He's an associate professor at UC Berkeley and also the co-founder of GoodGuide. So, Dara, about a year ago, we did a piece here on SeaChange Radio about nanoparticles. This is a segment that a lot of consumers don't know much about, but it's in more and more of these kind of products that you and your team review. And we really don't know the long-term health effects of these nanoparticles, which are in seemingly every new product. How do you quantify that, and how do you put it into your calculus?
Yeah, it is a really interesting issue. And one of the starting challenges of that issue, as you alluded to, is first, we know very little about the long-term human health or environmental impacts of releasing these nanoscale particles both into our bodies and then out into the environment. And so that's a big area where we're looking to cutting-edge academic and governmental and NGO research on what do we even know about these particles and their potential impacts. Do they cross the blood barrier when you put them on your skin? Are they going out into aquatic ecosystems? What do they do once they get out there? Lots and lots of questions about the long-term impacts. The other side of this that is a real challenge for us is there's very little requirement for companies to disclose the presence of nanoscale particles in their products. And for consumers who don't know where they would find nanoparticles, they are showing up again in a wide range of different product categories, from cosmetics and sunscreen, for instance, where the cosmetics industry has decided that people don't like, for instance, their sunscreen to go on white and for their face to have this kind of ghost effect when you spread sunscreens with physical blockers like titanium dioxide or zinc oxide on your skin. Traditional sunscreen particles have been nanoized so that they go on transparent. And this is something that I think industry has seen. Consumers would prefer sunscreen that is transparent and not white and doesn't have that ghost effect. So we see nanoscale particles showing up in sunscreens and in women's cosmetics. And again, we don't really know long-term potential human health impacts of that. We've got early studies coming out of Australia and other places that have been studying this, but really a lot of big questions. This goes all the way to, again, apparel. We're seeing nanoscale particles being applied to apparel. Washing machines that have nanotechnology in them for doing washing, electronics where we're seeing nanoscale chemistries being applied. So it's really popping up all around the consumer marketplace. And again, very little transparency, particularly for products that don't have ingredient lists. Very hard for a consumer to know whether there's nanotechnology in the product or not.
Where are some of the trickier food products for you and your colleagues to make determinations on in terms of long-term health benefits or fears similar to nanotechnology?
So there are continued huge debates over even the most basic labeling and transparency of what's in our food. We saw two major referenda in the United States just this week were defeated by multi-million dollar lobbying campaigns to block requirement for instance, GMO labeling. So there is a battle in the food aisles over disclosure and transparency that is really pretty amazing for 2014, that consumers in the U.S. still often don't know what's in the food product. And when we see these kind of food scandals break, still amazing how little we know about even where our food came from. The inability to trace back to a specific farm when we have E. coli or salmonella outbreaks. So the genetic modification of crops, big issue. But even kind of on the other end, things like high fructose corn syrup. What do we know about this sugar substitute that has been showing up again across the food aisle, not just in your soda, but in all sorts of different products where high fructose corn syrup has been added to products, and big questions about what are the implications for childhood obesity, for type 2 diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. And consumers we see more and more just want to know. They want to know what's in the product, and then they can choose. Do they want to avoid it or not avoid it? And so from there, we go to more controversial early stage health concerns around things like artificial colors, where research coming out of the UK that has indicated potential connections to ADHD from not the sugar in the candy or the cupcakes, but the artificial colors put on the cupcake or in the candy. And more consumers are becoming aware of those things and want to know, okay, what specific ingredients are in this product, in that 70 ingredient list on my processed food? And are there ones specifically that I want to avoid? So in the back in the personal care category in cosmetics, we see the fragrance industry continues to fight a battle to block any disclosure of any of the ingredients within fragrances.
Any ingredients.
Any ingredient. They, when you look at personal care products, your shampoo or your cosmetics, most of them have some fragrance in it. You know, this will be a surprise for your listeners, but the, you know, floral apple shampoo that you buy doesn't actually have apples or flowers in it.
No.
It has a chemical that was probably developed somewhere in New Jersey or somewhere else around the world that creates that smell.
So you're not just talking about cologne and no, fragrance. No. You're talking about when you see something in a product and it says fragrance.
Exactly.
Why can't we know more about that generic term?
Because the fragrance industry has been very effective in lobbying for a loophole in disclosure in which they are not required to disclose. So if you look at your shampoo or your body wash or your deodorant, it will have an ingredient list. And one of those ingredients will just say fragrance or parfum or something. And within that one word fragrance might be 40 or 50 or 70 chemicals that make up the fragrance.
Dara O'Rourke, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once, no, never, never, never.
My next guest on Sea Change Radio is the CEO of Makani Power, Corwin Hardam. Corwin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
First, tell our listeners, what is Makani Power?
Makani Power is a startup in renewable energy and wind. And so we're looking at a new way of doing wind energy conversion. And we're looking at, so converting the energy in the wind into electrons, into electricity. And as opposed to using a turbine, one of those three-bladed large things you see on the side of the road in various places around California, particularly Palm Springs or Altamont Pass. We're looking at actually using something that looks like almost like a kite. So it's a wing that's attached to the ground with a flexible tether. And as that wing flies around, it's got small rotors on it, and those rotors convert the speed of the kite into electricity and then send that electricity down to the ground where it can be used just as electricity generated from a wind turbine or a coal-fired power plant.
And you're funded by?
We're funded by Google. And also recently we won one of the RPE grants from the DOE. And we're actually working two milestones to that RPE project at this time. So we're developing a 20 kilowatt scale model of our airborne wind turbine, which we'll be flying in the next couple of months.
And for our listeners, what does a 20 kilowatt system mean in terms of how many households?
Yeah, so 20 kilowatts is about 10 households. Usual household in the U.S. is about 2 kilowatts on average power consumption.
And how does it compare to the large turbines that we see in an Altamont Pass and other wind farms that listeners may have noticed driving by?
Makani Power is focused on the utility-scale energy generation market. We're not interested in building individual small-scale generation equipment. And the reason for that is the fixed cost of the Makani system, the fixed cost of an airborne wind turbine, are relatively high at small scales. So whereas you can have a small wind turbine on top of your house, has one moving part, no electronics or very little electronics, our system has to have its own autonomous navigation system built into it, which is somewhat expensive relative to the scale of a small device. at utility scale, at megawatt scale, similar to the large structure, you know, the 300-foot tall turbines that you see at the very large wind farms, that cost of that avionics system is very small. And for that reason, because of these fixed parts that we have to put into our system, we focus on doing these larger scale devices. And the reason for having the fixed costs are not the only reason we focus on utility scale. At utility scale, we see some very significant performance improvements on the system. So larger scale systems tend to perform better than smaller scale systems, and they're easier to fly as well.
Can you talk about how you envision Makani Power being able to roll out enough of these airborne wind turbines to produce enough power to begin to deliver electricity on a mass scale to consumers?
This technology is capable of producing energy twice as often, so twice as much energy per single system, with only about 20% of the material.
Is that because of the altitude generally?
It's actually has very little to do with the altitude and has much more to do with the way the device operates. The way this technology works can be thought of almost identically to a wind turbine, so it's exactly the same physics. You start with a wind turbine blade, and if you look at a wind turbine blade is moving very quickly at the tip and very slowly at the center. Now, if you look at the very tip of the wind turbine, it is the most effective part of the wind turbine as far as generating energy. And what that means is that since it's going the fastest, it's also sweeping through the most area. And what you'd like to do is you'd like to just have that very effective tip. So, in fact, what we've done with Makani is we've made a wing that's tethered to the ground, which mimics the effectiveness of the tip of the wind turbine. And what's interesting about the Makani system is because we're tethered to the ground, we're no longer constrained to fly around that small annulus that a wind turbine tip does. We can now sweep through the sky in a much larger circle. So imagine a circle that's maybe 1,000 feet up, and it's maybe 500 feet in radius. So it's a very, very large circle that we're flying through. And by virtue of that, we sweep through a very large section of the sky. But more importantly, the entire wing, which is about the same size as one blade of a wind turbine, is moving at this higher speed. And so therefore, it's able to see much more of the wind than a wind turbine would. And by virtue of that, is exposed to much more wind energy.
And when you talk about one wing, there's a multiplier effect as well with these wings in terms of scaling this out to the masses, right?
So you can certainly install multiple systems. And the neat thing about that is that because the wing and the tether are very lightweight, so our single system mass is about 20% of that of a conventional wind turbine. So we're much, much lighter than a conventional wind turbine. And that means that it's easier to deploy these. You don't need any cranes. These systems actually launch and land themselves completely under computer control. And the other thing that's very nice is there's no very large infrastructure required to manufacture them. So the wing itself is fiberglass and carbon fiber. It can be made in many different fiberglass shops. It certainly can be made in wind turbine blade manufacturing shops. The tether is carbon fiber as well, and the ground station is metal and concrete, but it's much, much lighter than a wind turbine tower or the nacelle, and particularly the hub and some of the large mechanical pieces that are up in a wind turbine. What's neat about that is that as you look at technologies that can scale very rapidly to meet an opportunity, a resource opportunity, this technology, airborne wind turbines, is very suited to rapid scalability because we're very lightweight, so it's easy to deploy, and also by virtue of the fact that we're low mass, it's easy to manufacture. And take that one step further, the components, the simplicity of the components is relatively well matched to what the existing manufacturer base is that can be found just about anywhere across the world.
Can you walk us through the invention of airborne wind turbines? Is Makani the first of its kind to produce an airborne wind turbine like this?
So Makani is certainly not the first of its kind. I would say we are the first to demonstrate that the idea is indeed possible. So we're the first to have done autonomous flight of a tethered wing, autonomous power generation, and transitions from hover to crosswind flight with a tethered vehicle. So those are sort of first demonstrations of enabling of the technology. But there have been many instances where people have looked at this in the past. So in the 1970s, a fellow by the name of Miles Lloyd at Lawrence Livermore Lab wrote an extensive paper on this technology, and he highlighted and then patented most of the fundamental tenets of the idea. Since then, what we've done is developed and enabled and actually realized the invention in a prototype.
What about planes and birds? Are these going to be in peril as Makani rolls out more and more of these wind farms?
There's a couple of things, first of all, to set straight. The Makani, we're not flying that high. Even at utility scale, we fly at around 1,000 feet. So 1,000 feet is, there are buildings that are that tall, there are radio towers that tall. So the FAA is used to, maybe I shouldn't say used to, but they have certainly negotiated this problem before in the past. And the way that this is done is you note where those are on pilots' maps, and you, of course, have to notify airmen where those farms are, where we would be putting these farms. And then it seems like it's a solvable problem. And it's not something that the FAA has published a rule set on. It's something we're working with them on. But it is something that I think we can navigate safely, such that we don't run into planes. Planes don't run into us. There are a number of hurdles with land use and competing desires for land use and so forth. First of all, one of the nice things about Makani is because we are much more insensitive to resource. In other words, we can operate in less wind than a conventional turbine. We're more flexible about siting. So if, for example, you have a choice about siting, you can decide to site outside of, say, a migratory path, a place where perhaps birds of prey might want to fly, in other words, a ridgetop or something like that. And we can also avoid siting in places where people would have complaints about, you know, changes to their view shed and so forth. So being able to site in many different places is a huge improvement over the existing technology, having that flexibility. In terms of, specifically in terms of birds, I think it's important to stress that there has been a little bit of a misconception by virtue of some of the stuff that was seen in very early turbines, but in general, modern turbines kill very, very few birds. Almost none.
Probably a lot less than oil.
Certainly a lot less than oil, but really, frankly, dramatically less than buildings, dramatically less than cars, all dramatically less than cats, for that matter.
Really?
So there's a lot of... There are some misconceptions about that. I still think that it's something to be very sensitive to and something we plan to be very sensitive to as well.
Well, it's a fascinating technology, and we really appreciate you walking us through it. Corwin Hardam, the CEO of Makani Power, thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Robert Walter, Jeff Buckley, and Kat Stevens. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.